Okay, so we're really interested in what makes an accurate model of a molecule. How do we understand molecular structure and molecular energy in terms of these models that have atoms connected by bonds? So we talked about shape, strain energy, the idea that Beyer had that if the angles of a saturated carbon were not 109.5 degrees, that then there'd be extra energy in the molecule. But this was generalized somewhat more than 50 years later to the idea that you could actually treat these models as if they were mechanical. That is, as if there really were springs holding things together with a given Hooke's law force constant for stretching, for bending, even for twisting. So the idea of having Hooke's law for strain energy, and we began looking at this last time at this paper that was published in 1946 about applying calculations to determine energy. The particular energy they were interested in was the energy that's involved in twisting about the central bond of two benzene rings hooked together. So if you have a model like this, of just two benzene rings hooked together, obviously it's easy to twist, right? Even if you put a larger group on here, for example, if I can put it on here, right? It still is easy to twist. But this might not be accurate in that respect, because if one fleshed out the hydrogen atoms here, the carbon atom here, the hydrogen atom here, the carbon atom here, they might run into one another, right, making it hard to twist. And because of that, as we said last time, a molecule like this one can't be flat because the bromine here and the hydrogen would come too close together. In fact, it became useful ultimately to make space-filling models like this, where you had different size of atoms. For example, here's a chlorine, here's bromine, and here's iodine. And you see they're successively larger. Okay, but is that real? Okay, so if there were reality to it, then maybe you could do a thing like this, where you measure how rapidly this could interconvert between the one that's twisted one way, the one that's twisted the other, the mirror images. And you measure it by measuring how long it takes to interconvert between the two, 10 to the minus 2 seconds. And I asked this question last time. But the important thing they did was to use a thing like Hooke's law in here to calculate the energy. So you get a certain geometry, you can calculate the energy. It was hard in those days when you used pencil and paper. It's easy now when you can use a computer to do the calculations of the geometry, the distances, and therefore, through this, the energies. Okay. And what they noticed already at that time was that when you get the barrier, you don't just make these two close together. You relieve that by moving the bromine back and opening this angle. Open it by 12 degrees in order to be able to make the bromine pass by the hydrogen. So molecular mechanics programs that are widely available now can calculate and can minimize, as we'll demonstrate, the strain, assuming that molecules can be treated as mechanical entities. Okay, but the price you have to pay for this is that you need lots and lots of empirical constants. How strong are these springs? What's the natural distance of a bond that you distort either by lengthening or compressing with a spring? Can you treat them as simple springs, or do you have to be more complicated than Hooke's simple law in order to make the energies match experiments, or nowadays reliable quantum calculations? So these parameters that go into a system I'm going to illustrate. So one common type of molecular mechanics program is called MM2, and the parameters in that program require that you have 66 different types of atoms. For example, The periodic table is bigger than that, but you don't try to treat the whole periodic table, only the atoms you're likely to encounter. So, for example, that 66 different types of atoms includes 14 different types of carbon atoms. So a carbon atom isn't a carbon atom in this method. So there's type number one is a carbon atom that's in an alkane. Number two is in an alkene, in a double bond. Number four is an alkyne, a triple bond. Number three is a carbonyl carbon. They also use type three if they're in this particular set of parameters if they talk about a carboxylate. But in some other sets of parameters, they use a different carbon if it's a part of a carboxylic acid than if it's part of a ketone. Okay? Or if you have a carbon that's in a chain of double bonds, you use a different type, type 4, which is the same as alkyne in this set, but it could be different. If it's cyclopentadienyl, it's type 63, and so on. So it requires lots of different types of atoms. And then, so there are 138 different kinds of bond stretching, right? And 41 alkane, one that involved type 1. Notice that all these have as the first atom in the bond type 1. Okay? But then 41 different other atoms, which might be other carbons, right? So 1,1 is alkane with alkane. 1,2 is alkane with an alkene carbon. And 1,3 is an alkane with a carbonyl carbon, right? So you have 41 different alkane carbon to X bond stretching sets of parameters, okay, among the 138 altogether in this particular set of for molecular mechanics. So each of these has, I forget whether I labeled these, no I didn't, what the natural bond length is and what Hooke's law force constant is for stretching or compressing it, right? And then there are 624 different bond bendings for the angle, right? 41 that involve alkane carbon, and then some other atom. So here's alkane, 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 alkene. Got the idea? Each of these is a particular bond that's being bent. And now in each of these you have some force constant. There's a value depending on, XR2, XRH, XH2. So this is the natural bond angle from which you distort. These are all very near tetrahedral angles, but some of them depart a little bit, and it depends on what other substituents there are on the X, right? If the X has two R groups on it, or an R and an H, or two H's, you have slightly different values for this. Now, how do you find these? You find them by changing it until you make your calculations agree with some measurements that are made experimentally or quantum mechanically. Okay? Then you can talk about not only the bond stretching, right? The bond bending. You can also talk about the bond twisting, right? That's the torsional angle, right? Eclipsed, gauche, anti, right? Now for this, you see, and again, you have all the different types of atoms that you can have in this chain of four, right? And there are 37 that involve alkane, 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 and then some X. Okay, now you have three parameters that you have to determine. Let's see what those are. So V3 is a threefold rotational barrier. So that's the height of this energy curve that goes up and down three times as you rotate through 360 degrees. So that's called a threefold barrier. We talked about that in ethane. Okay, but there's also a parameter that you put in for a twofold barrier. That's how high this curve is, which goes down, up and down only twice during a 360 degree rotation about that central bond, right? And then there's V1, which only goes down once and back up during that. If you add all three of these together, you get that energy. So that's what this particular program decides is the energy involved in twisting around the central bond, the sum of those three terms. But you need all those parameters in order to get that, the V1, the V2, and the V3. Now, notice that that goes up and down less than a kilocalorie per mole. It goes up just a little over 0.5 and down a little over 0.2 or 0.3. Okay. Now compare that with what we already know about the torsional energy for rotation in butane, right, with four carbons in a row. That, remember, the difference between ante and gauche is 0.9 kilocalories per mole. So much bigger than this energy that's put in for this energy of twisting around the double bond. And in fact, the barrier here to go from ante to gauche is 3.5 kilocalories, way off scale here. So not very much of it is actually due to this potential. It's due to other things that are put into the calculation. In particular, to the interaction through space between these methyl groups, or the methyl and the hydrogen down here, right? When it's eclipsed out here, it's not this high. It's 5.5 kilocalories, or even more high. Right, because those things are running into one another. Or here in the gauche, here, right, that it's high. Notice that for this potential that you're putting in for the twisting, right, that part of it that is actually lower for gauche than it is for ante. But that's overwhelmed by the fact that in the gauche, the methyl groups are near one another compared to where they are in the ante. So there are lots and lots of offsetting things here. And you can get fundamentally the same results by making one bigger and the other smaller for anything. So there's a lot of arbitrariness in this about how you adjust these parameters to make it reproduce a certain set of observations. Okay. So that one's low because of van der Waals, 180 degrees is low because of low van der Waals repulsion between these two methyl groups. Okay, so all this whole potential here, all these parameters that are being put in, are just to do this little bit of tweaking of the energy. The big parts are coming in this particular calculation, mechanical calculation, from other sources. So after simplification and saying some things we're going to take to be equal to other things, just so you don't have two things that you have to determine. After lots of simplification, there's still more than 2,000 arbitrarily adjustable parameters in this model. So there's nothing fundamental about a molecular mechanics calculation because all these things have been adjusted arbitrarily. And contrast that with quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, the only things you put in are the mass of the particles, which are fundamental constants, and their charges, which are fundamental constant, and Planck's constant. Once you've got that, if you believe Schrödinger, you can calculate everything, rather than having 2,000, more than 2,000 arbitrarily adjusted parameters. The only problem is that it's much easier to calculate the stretching of a spring than it is to find solutions of Schrödinger's equation, even approximate solutions of Schrödinger's equation. So there's great utility to these molecular mechanics programs, even though fundamentally they're not true. Now, there are lots of different schemes. I showed you parameters just for this particular scheme. But if you go to Wikipedia and look for force fields in chemistry, you find this list of different force fields that people have compiled to do this kind of calculation. This is one, CHARM, the H-A-R is from Harvard, and here OPLS is one that was developed at Yale, incidentally. But all these different sets of parameters that people have tried and applied for different applications. So, you know, none of them is really fundamental. They're all highly empirical. But if you want to do a complicated molecule, you can't do it easily with quantum mechanics. So we've come a long way from Cooper and Crumb, Brown, and Dewar when we just drew these lines between atoms. Now you're assigning reality to those lines as if they were, or at least approximate reality, as if they were springs and so on. Okay, now let's look at what you can do with the kind of thing you can do with molecular mechanics. So you can take ideal cyclohexane, which we talked about drawing last time, and we can evaluate its energy by molecular mechanics. Now, when you use quantum mechanics, you calculate the energy relative to the separated particles, right? The energy you calculate in molecular mechanics is the energy due to distorting the molecule. You start with normal bond distances, bond angles, and so on, and then you distort them, so you only measure this tiny energy that's involved in the distortion compared to the enormous energy that was released when the atoms came together from infinity and formed the molecules, formed the bonds. Okay, so we start with an ideal structure, which means we'll take the normal bond distances, the normal 109.5 degree bond angle. So there's going to be no strain associated with that. Incidentally, when you do calculations with this particular program, there's also another energy that is involved, not just stretching a spring, not just bending a spring, but it could be that when you stretch a spring, it becomes easier to bend. Or it could be that when you stretch a spring, it becomes harder to bend for these bonds and molecules. So there's a correction that's put in that's called stretch bend. But of course, if neither of them is distorted, if they're at their natural distance, there's no interaction due to that either. Then there's torsion. Notice the lowest energy torsion about, say, this bond would be to have this carbon, and this carbon anti to one another. You know, that's the lowest energy in butane, right? But here, to be in a ring, they have to be twisted, right? So there's going to be energy due to torsion, that kind of thing we were just talking about. And in this particular calculation, that's said to be 2.12 kilocalories per mole. And here we illustrate it. There's the Gauche-CCC bond angle, torsional angle. Now, there are things also called van der Waals energies, which involve atoms that are not so closely connected, that are not just due to the bonds. Remember I said that the big difference between anti-butane and gauche-butane is not what the program calls torsion, right, which actually was lower for gauche than for anti. The big one was how far apart these methyls are, that they're closer together when it's gauche than when it's anti, right? So there's these van der Waals interactions. Now, the program, in order to calculate these, can't use the same parameters always. It would be great if you could always have the same van der Waals parameters that depended only on the distance between atoms. But the program, to work, finds that it can't do it that simply. It has to use different values if they're connected by three bonds, so 1, 2, 3, 4, right? So that's 1,4 van der Waals interaction, the one in bromine between these two, the one in butane between these two carbons. Okay? But if it were further on out here someplace interacting with that, that's not 1,4. That's further than 1,4. So the program finds that it has to use different values for those. It can't use the same values. It would be great if it could, but it can't. You get the wrong. So there's non 1,4 van der Waals interaction, which you'll notice is negative. That means it's favorable in energy compared to the atoms at their standard distance. How could that be? For example, this interaction between this carbon, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 atoms in the chain, so it's a 1,5, not a 1,4 van der Waals interaction. That distance is such that there's actually attraction between them. It's a low energy, not a high energy due to that. Remember that the dispersion interaction, the correlation of electrons in atoms at long distance, will be on average such that they attract one another a little bit. So it's not a very big energy, and it's not just for this interaction. It's for the sum of all such interactions in the molecule, all non-1,4 van der Waals interactions. And finally, the sixth contribution that this particular program makes to calculating the conformational energy is the 1,4 van der Waals interactions, which is unfavorable in toto by 6.32. And that's, for example, this. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4. So this hydrogen is closer than it wants to be to that carbon, other things being equal. So that's a 1,4 van der Waals interaction and is unfavorable, right, in total over all the 1,4s by 6.32. Okay, so that's the energy for this ideal structure of cyclopropane. But maybe cyclopropane can lower its energy by changing its structure, not be the ideal one with 100, 109.5 degree bond angles and so on. Now, so, but that's easy programmed. I mean, it takes a lot of time, and people spent a lot of time writing all these different programs and finding the parameters for them. But once you got it, all you got to do is press a button, and the computer can adjust the structure and find what the lowest energy is. In this particular case, cyclohexane, with this particular program, instead of a total of 7.89 kilocalories per mole, it turns out that if you relax the cyclohexane and to get minimized values, you change. Notice there's a cost to the change, that you have to stretch or compress bonds, so it's no longer zero for stretching. You have to bend bonds, right? So it's no longer zero. Then there's also a little contribution from this stretch-bend interaction, which is small. And the torsion gets a little bit worse, right? But the non-1,4 van der Waals interactions gets better, more negative, by half a kilocalorie per mole. And especially the 1,4 van der Waals interactions get better by 1.5 kilocalories per mole. And in total, you've lowered the energy from 7.89 to 6.56 kilocalories per mole. Now, what is it that happened to the geometry in order to realize this change? So it stretches and flattens slightly to reduce these van der Waals energies. So if we look at the molecule there and then do the distortion, you see that it flattens out a little bit, which pulls these hydrogens away. Remember, there was a bad interaction between hydrogen 20 here and carbon 2. But by flattening, it pulled it out a little bit. I think you can see it there, but here it is with all the axial bonds strictly parallel to the threefold axis. But in truth, it flattens out a little bit so that those move away from one another. Or at least in MM2, if not in truth. It is in truth too. The actual bond angles here in cyclohexane are 112 degrees, not 109 degrees. So they're going toward 120, which is what it would be if it were flat. Okay. Now notice that in cyclohexane you have a gauche-butane. Okay? In fact, you have six gauche-butanes because every carbon-carbon bond is the center bond of four carbons in a row, right? That's a gauche-butane. Now, we know how much gauche-butane costs, right? It's 0.9 kilocalories per mole, right? And here we have six gauche-butanes. So 6 times 0.9 would be 5.4, which is certainly order of magnitude the same as the strain energy in cyclohexane, actually, right? So that's maybe as much an accident as anything else, but at least it's a good mnemonic device to allow you to remember what the strain energy in cyclohexane is. It's six gauche-butanes. Okay? Now, suppose you change cyclohexane to put a T-butyl group on, to put a methyl group on up at the top in the axial position. Now you're going to have problems because now you've made this, remember there was an unfavorable interaction between here and here before. Now you've got a carbon atom instead of a hydrogen atom, and more hydrogens attached that are going to be touching things over here. So if this tangency through space means anything, or proximity in space means anything, then you're going to have strain due to that. Okay, so in this idealized with a vertical axial carbon-carbon bond for the methyl group, you have no stretching, no bending. That's what we mean by idealized. There's a certain amount of torsional energy, but now you have much bigger van der Waals interactions because of these extra interactions here, and there's a total strain energy of 16.5 kilocalories per mole. And a lot of it's due to this one non-1,4. You look at this hydrogen 20 here, which is very close to those two. So you can relax it. And instead of having the non-1,4 be plus 6.12, you can change it to be minus 1.31. Instead of 7.61 for the 1,4, you can go to 5.31. And it's pretty obvious what you're going to do. You're going to do the same kind of flattening, but especially to get this methyl group out of the way. So if we look at what the program does, you can see how it moves it back. Okay? So it's no longer the idealized axial strictly parallel to the threefold axis kind of structure. But it now has only 8.6 energy compared to an idealized model as opposed to 16.55. Okay, so there we go back and forward again, and you can see the motion that they do. Okay, so it's 8.66. Now, in substituted cyclohexanes, like this one is substituted with methyl, you notice what you've done is add another gauche butane. This red is four atoms in a row, four carbon atoms in a row, and they're gauche, when the lowest energy would be anti, right? Or the point of reference would be anti. So we're going to add a gauche butane interaction here, but also the purple one is a gauche butane interaction. So when you put an axial substituent in, you go from six gauche butanes, the one you had going around the ring, to eight gauche butanes, right? Which would be about 8 kilocalories per mole. And remember, it was 8.66. So again, it's more accidental probably than anything else, but at least it's memorable. Now, had the substituent on this carbon been equatorial instead of axial, then you notice those things that were gauche would now be anti. So in going from axial to equatorial, you go twice from gauche to anti. Right? And the energy difference, remember what the energy difference is between gauche and anti? 0.9. Right? And this is twice that, very close. Okay, so it's two gauches going to two antis. Okay, now, this energy difference between axial and equatorial, therefore, is a sort of maybe generalizable empirical measure of how big a group is. The bigger a group is, the more it should hurt to be up here as compared to out here. Okay? So if we can measure the energy difference between those, and those energy differences can be measured by NMR, and we'll talk about that next semester, how you can measure it. But if you can measure it, then you have some sort of measure of the group size, the effective size of the group that you put on the cyclohexane ring. So you can find tables of what are called A values, which is the difference in energy between axial and equatorial. Now, in the case of hydrogen, if you wanted to start with that in your table, what's the difference between axial and equatorial? It's zero, because you got a hydrogen here and a hydrogen here. If you exchange them, you still got a hydrogen here and a hydrogen there. So hydrogen would be zero in this table. But if you put fluorine in, it's a little bigger than hydrogen. So it costs 0.3 kilocalories per mole to have it be axial rather than equatorial. Everybody with me on this? Okay. Chlorine is bigger than fluorine, so it costs twice as much to make it axial as compared to having the chlorine equatorial. So if you want to flip the ring, right? In the case of unsubstituted cyclohexane, you'd start and end at the same energy. But if you have a group here like fluorine, that one would be 0.3 kilocalories higher than that one. So at the equilibrium, you could calculate what the equilibrium constant would be and how much more there would be equatorial when it can flip back and forth easily and equilibrate rather than axial. Okay, now I want somebody to guess what it's going to be for bromine. See if we can learn something that's not easily predictable. Or maybe it is easily predictable. Matt, you're sitting here. Yeah, bromine's bigger than chlorine, so what are you going to guess?
0.9.
And iodine is 0.6, too. So why aren't these getting bigger? Here are these models I showed you of chlorine, bromine, and iodine. They're clearly getting bigger. What's going on? Okay. Well, let's look at how they would fit into this picture. There's fluorine. To make that sphere, we had to know the carbon-fluorine distance and the fluorine atom van der Waals radius. Okay? Now, we do the same thing for chlorine, and in fact, it does get closer over here. Right? There's the carbon-chlorine distance and the chlorine van der Waals radius. Can anybody see why it might be that it doesn't get, the A value doesn't get bigger when you go to bromine and iodine? Christina? Ah, because there are two factors going on. How long the bond is, which gets the group further away, and how big the group is, which gets it closer to these things. So if we do it then for bromine, it's out there. And if we do it for iodine, it's out there. And you notice, by chance, all of these have the same proximity, chlorine, bromine, and iodine, to these hydrogens here. Isn't that curious? So that's... when you see things that don't go in a smooth trend, right, it tends to indicate that there are two things going on that are fighting one another, right? Here it's the bond distance and the atomic radius. But at any rate, there are these tables of A values that give you some idea of what conformational energies might be. So the van der Waals radius increase is offset by the increasing CX distance. Now, we can look at it also for alkyl groups here. We've already looked at the methyl group. Its A value is 1.7 kilocalories per mole. That's what we just calculated, okay, or we saw it here. Okay. Now, suppose instead of a methyl group there, we put an ethyl group up there, another carbon. So what are we going to guess for that? Well, notice it's hardly bigger at all. It's 1.8. Why doesn't putting another methyl group on this carbon make it much worse? What? Well, because you can stick it out here someplace, off in left field, where it's not touching anything. Okay? Isopropyl is just a little bit bigger, right? What value are you going to predict for T-butyl? 1.7, 1.8, 2.2. What are you going to predict? 4.8. Why is it so much worse to put the third one on compared to the first two? Yeah, Lauren? Ah, the first one can go here, the second one can go here, but the third one has to go here. Right now, really close. Right, there's one. There's two, but there's the third. That's the one that really generates a lot of trouble. Okay? But notice how different this is from the kind of model that Cooper or Crum Brown or Kekulé or any of those guys was thinking about. We're actually thinking about these things as something that have sizes and standard distances in three-dimensional space. So there's no good torsional angle for rotation around this carbon-carbon bond. If you have three of those, one of them has to be in the bad position. Now, let's think about cyclobutane. Okay, now, cyclobutane, remember, why is cyclobutane strained? Why does it have, Bayer's point of view, it was reactive. From our point of view, if we calculated it in molecular mechanics, we'd find it has high strain energy, right? Why? What's bad? If you do the calculation, what's bad about cyclobutane? Can you guess? The bond angle. That's what Bayer thought. Okay, and when we look here, we see that that's true. There's in the planar structure, right, there's a little bit of stretching, but there's an enormous strain due to bending, right? And then there's strain due to torsion because these series of four successive carbons are eclipsed. Right? And the hydrogens here are eclipsed with one another. If we sighted down this bond, this hydrogen would be on top of that one, this one on top of that one. So there's a lot of torsional strain. Now, if you use molecular mechanics, you can allow it to deviate from being planar to pucker. Right? And watch what happens to the energy when you pucker it. Right? The bending energy gets bigger. Because if you pucker it, the angles get smaller. They're already too small at 90 degrees. Puckering, it's going to cost you in terms of bending. But look what it does to torsion. It lowers it by 3.5 kilocalories per mole. Right? So you get more back in profit from losing torsional strain than you pay in bending strain. So the actual structure of cyclobutane is puckered like that, not planar. Okay? So it's a competition between torsion, which is getting better, and bending, which is getting worse. Okay? Or if we take cyclopentane, do you remember how much strain energy there is in bending the bonds in cyclopentane when you have a five-membered ring? Zero, almost, right? It's almost exactly the tetrahedral angle in a planar pentagon, right? And you see here that the strain is negligible, really, just half a kilocalorie in the planar structure. But you still have enormous torsional energy because these things are all eclipsed going around here. So what the molecule actually does is bend this carbon down and bend this one up a little bit. So notice this is no longer exactly eclipsed along here, nor are any of them eclipsed. This one, to go along this bond from 8 to 10, it's almost staggered. Notice that this 14 is almost in the middle between 9 and 11, right? So that's sometimes said to be the envelope structure. Okay? And notice what it says in this envelope structure. You had to pay in bending because the angles were just right to begin with, tetrahedral. But you had to make them sharper in order to do this puckering. But you made back for it in the torsional energy. Also, it got better in terms of the van der Waals energy. Okay? So, like a plastic model, molecular mechanics is satisfying because it not only says what the structure should be, the minimum energy structure, but it says why. What are you bending? What are you twisting? And so on, that makes the energy be the way it is. Quantum mechanics, you get good values, better values. You don't have to do all the parameterization, so it's more believable. But you can't say why. Okay. Now let's think about. Let me pass these around again so you can feel them. I forget. Well, I'll start on this side this time because I started on the other side last time. So do this thing again of flipping back and forth. I'll let you start, Mary. Here, flipping back and forth between axial and equatorial, and you feel. You want to get from one chair to the other. So remember how you do it? First, you hold the two opposite sides, twist one down and then the other up. Yeah, you got it here. There, okay. But you feel a click when you do that. You feel a click, not as well in the model that's in the back there, because it's made out of softer plastic than these ones, which are more likely to break up in front. Now, why is it, when you fiddle with that model, what is it that you feel that makes a barrier to flipping from one chair to the other, to go from chair to boat or twist boat to chair? So what's the source of the barrier to the cyclohexane ring flip? Okay, the molecules do it, and the models do it. Do the models do it for the correct reason? Okay. Now, so when we move that atom up, the first step in this flip, we make those five carbons pretty close to coplanar, right? And that's hard to do. But once you get it past, then it clicks and goes downhill in energy, and you can feel that. Now, we could say that when we get to having these five all in a plane, this is the torsional angle around this bond is eclipsed, right? This carbon is right on top of that one if you sight down this bond. This hydrogen on top of that one, this hydrogen on top of that one. The same is true of this carbon-carbon bond, that at this high energy point, it's eclipsed, right? And we know in our molecular mechanics that going from, or either from experiment, that two butanes going from gauche to eclipsed costs energy about 7 kilocalories per mole, right? But in these plastic models, it doesn't cost it. There is no barrier to twisting. Right? So that can't be the reason that the models do it. So why do the models do it? What is it in the model that makes it, when I go like this, it's getting more and more strained, and then it clicks? And the same, when I go from here to here, it gets more and more strained, and then it clicks, and I've gone from axial to equatorial with that. In these models, it can't be the torsion that's doing it, because there is no torsion in these models. So what is it? Yeah, Amy? Why the bend? It could be the bend, yeah.
Is it because the bonds in the model are completely rigid, so you can't have
them? Yeah, you're saying the same thing, that it's the bend. But notice that what happened when we did this, if we put this carbon down as well into the plane, then this would be a planar hexagon, and the angles would all be 120 degrees. That would clearly be strained. But it has to be strained even when you make only five, for that same reason, even when you make only five of them coplanar. All right? That this is in that structure, when this one is out of the plane, but these five are all in the plane, these have been increased in angle by between 5 and 7 degrees. This one has been decreased in angle by 3 degrees. So that's the source of the strain in these models that we're passing around. Right? It's the angle strain, not torsional strain. So there really is both kinds of strain, right? As molecular mechanics shows it. But in the model, what we see for the click is this, which is also a contributor, of course, in the real case. Okay. Incidentally, the actual transition state is thought to be what's called a half chair. So those, not five in a plane, but four in a plane, and then the other two up and down. So these five along here are not actually in a plane. If you do molecular mechanics, you can find what the really lowest energy maximum is that you have to go through to get from one to the other. Now, are molecular mechanics programs useful? Definitely. If you want to know the shape of some complicated molecule, that's by far the most efficient way to find it out. And people have spent a lot of time parameterizing these. In fact, lots of different parameterizations of it. So as we work with more complex systems, they become ever more indispensable. There's another question, are they true? And here the answer is definitely no, that molecules aren't springs and so on. The quantum mechanics is the real thing. That's why Wikipedia alone lists 34 different schemes of 11 different types of schemes to do this and apply them, some for proteins of one class, some for other kinds of molecules and so on. So they can be very useful, but they're fundamentally untrue. And one of the interesting examples of their being untrue has to do with bromine-bromine contact. So suppose we take a lot of molecules, do crystal structures, and find that they have carbon-bromine bonds here. So we'll put the carbon, we'll rotate all these structures so they all have their carbon here and their bromine here. And now we'll look for where there are other bromines nearby in those different crystal structures. And we'll plot the position of the nearby bromines. Okay? Now, that's the van der Waals radius of bromine, 1.9 angstroms, right? So there could be other bromines at different angles relative to this, and they should fall along that if they're in contact. Of course, they could be further, right? But they shouldn't be much closer. Okay? Now, so this should be the allowed locus for bromine neighbors within 5 angstroms. The outer radius here is 5 angstroms. This would be van der Waals contact. Now, there will be some a little bit closer because, remember, long-range atoms have attraction to one another. So if you have two molecules, all the atoms in these molecules are attracting one another. So they'll come together until the closest ones touch. That now becomes repulsive. But they'll come a little bit closer so that, because there's still attraction between the ones that are far out here, they'll go until it's balanced by repulsion between the ones that are near. Okay? So they'll get a little bit closer than that, the closest ones. So maybe in here. Right? So this is the locus we expect to see neighboring bromines from lots and lots of different crystal structures. This is what's actually found. That was in 1985. So indeed, there are a lot along this curve that those are the ones that are in contact, and some further away that aren't quite in contact, and some closer together that are being squeezed together. But notice what's funny about this distribution? Yeah. What's funny? What? Ah, they get much closer at the top than they do at the side. Right? So what would you conclude from this? Pardon me? Well, it could have to do with repulsion and other things, because there are other things attached here, not just the carbon, but this is a part of a molecule, and there are other things attached, right? But I think the simplest thing to explain this is that the bromine is not spherical, right? That it has a shorter radius along the carbon-bromine bond than sideways. But all molecular mechanics programs, as far as I know, assume that bromines are spherical. Right? Now, of course, you could put in more parameters and correct for this, but you know, you already have more than 2,000 parameters. So you'd get a lot of problem if you started treating atoms as non-spherical. Right? But at any rate, the point is that these molecular mechanics programs are really valuable. And they're indispensable, but don't mistake that with their being true in any fundamental way. So molecular mechanics is necessary for complex structure. Now there's this anti-cancer drug called angiostatin, which actually has been calculated by quantum mechanics. Not a really high-level quantum mechanics, but they've minimized the energy of this molecule using quantum mechanics. This was they may have done bigger things by now. This one was done in 2003. So it had 1,200 atoms, 642 heavy, that is non-hydrogen, 578 hydrogen atoms. The job took 650 optimization steps, starting from a geometry. Notice the starting point they took was the minimum in energy from molecular mechanics, and then they refined it. But anyhow, this is not an everyday occurrence to do it. It's molecular mechanics that people use when they talk about the structure of big molecules. So is the standard structural model realistic in its geometric detail? How do you know? By checking against X-ray diffraction. So we're going to go on to this next time, but let me just give an introduction, a quick introduction. There is in Cambridge in the UK... a center that collects all crystal structures that have been determined by X-ray diffraction for smallish molecules, that is not proteins, but molecular crystals. And if you click here, you'll get taken to their site. And this is how many they had in their library, cumulative, of course, beginning in 1972. So X-ray has become much more available and much easier to do. So this last year, they hit 500,000 X-ray structures, and that's the one that was the 500,000th entry in there. If you click that site that I showed, it'll take you to this, and you can rotate this around. But it's curious in context of this lecture that it's precisely the sort of compound which will be twisted one way or the other and has a barrier to rotation. And this is actually the structure that you see here, and you see that it's twisted. It's not planar. So. And not only have you got more structures, but they're becoming more and more complicated. This molecule, I think, has 25 atoms in it, right? And in 1972, the average was 27 among there were maybe 5,000 or something like that, right? But as time has gone on, the molecules have become more complicated. So 56, 73... By 2008, the average molecule had 75 atoms in it. And that means that there's an enormous amount of data, because there are 500,000 molecules, the most recent ones averaging 75 atoms. There are 36 million atoms whose position is known precisely. And that means that more than 50 million bonds have been measured. So the question is, are they a standard length? Right? And for that, you'll have to come back on Monday. So we're going to have lectures on Monday and Wednesday. On Friday, we'll have a review session here in class. Okay? See you then.